leave my stuff here.
I do.
Yes. This hearing to order. This is our fourth hearing on accountability and our expectations and accountability. And first of all, I'd like to welcome all of you here. I appreciate the amount of time you've put in helping us work through and think through what we might do with the state's report card. When we began, and it seems like ages ago, but our first hearing was in October, and many of us began working on this in July, we set out to revise the state's report card so that we could assure the public that we had an accountability system that was both stable and meaningful. The purpose of our meeting today is to share with you a draft of a bill that begins to, it's our first crack at what we might recommend for the report card. And today's meeting is to open that draft for public comment. Before we do that, I think it's really important to pause and to thank all the people that have worked with us on this. And I'm going to begin first with Representative Brainerd, who has been absolutely relentless in her commitment to this project from a year ago, and keeping us on track and keeping us motivated. I'd also like to thank our staff. We have Lisa Larson from the House and Shelby McQuay and a number of other people, including my legislative assistant and our committee chair and all sorts of people who make these, put these hearings together and keep us on track. And the hours and hours that go into pulling this off are extremely high. And finally, and most importantly, I want to thank the experts from the university. I see many of them here today, and many of the people that you're going to hear testifying, the experts who gave us they already have very busy schedules, and they carved time out for us to share with us their knowledge and their recommendations. So it's kind of humbling to be at this point here that we're going to present something now to the public. For today's agenda, and we're going to try to move this as quickly as possible, we're going to take a review of the bill, and then there will be some comment from folks in the audience that, first we'll have some comments from some of the people that helped us shape the bill, and then we will take comment from folks in the audience. And I realize that not all of you have had the bill for very long, and this is not your only opportunity to give us input into the bill. I want to recap from our third hearing the criteria, or some of the comments and criteria that guided us. We began asking ourselves, could we design a realistic child-centered assessment system? And first and foremost, we wanted to recognize and we want to emphasize, and we're going to emphasize it, and we're going to emphasize it, that accountability is about learning. And that is our first and foremost thought. Some of the criteria that we set forth under that is, and these are the things I want you to think about as we review the bill. Does this bill foster the broad goals of education? Does this bill serve the audience for which it is intended? And if you recall, we specifically said we are going to address the report card that is for the parents and the public. This is not the whole data warehouse that our department provides for our professionals. Does this bill inform us about the quality of our schools and districts? Does this bill help impact achievement of students? And then finally, what are the feasibility of the things that we are recommending? So before I invite to the table our two assistants who will, analysts who will go through the bill with you, I want to turn the mic over to Representative Brainerd. Do you have some comments?
Thank you, Senator Rummel. First of all, if you wrote down all those questions that Senator Rummel asked, I don't think we'll be out of here by 8 o'clock tonight if we try to but answer those. But they are truly meant to be. This isn't sort of the opening of our discussion. So there will be, as Senator Rummel indicated, additional opportunity. And I'm going to start where I know Senator Rummel expected I would start, and that's every time I've spoken about this, I've gone back to the legislation that initiated this whole process because I believe it so clearly states our charge. When we removed the five stars from the report card last year, we also moved to constitute an advisory group that would move forward how we might best expand the report card measures. That advisory group was not funded in the final education bill, and so this committee has taken that charge to do legislative due diligence to the charge of that advisory group, and I'm just going to reread a couple sentences from there because, from my perspective, they completely surround our recommendations and are the context, the appropriate context to judge those recommendations in. So the charge to the advisory group is to consider and recommend how to structure school performance data and school performance report cards to fully, fairly, and accurately report student achievement and emphasize school excellence under Minnesota's system of educational accountability and public reporting. Then skipping a few sentences there, so dot, dot, dot. Using multiple performance measures that are objective and consistent with the highest standards in the field of educational measures and accountability. So the proposal you have before you, if you followed our hearings at all, you know that we heard from many, many people about potential indicators. And I, too, would like to echo Senator Rummel's gratitude to everyone who brought possible indicators to us to consider. And I'll just say, from our perspective, we responded somewhat conservatively to the recommendations that came before us, and that is we ended up considering three potential indicators out of the multitude that was put before us, not because they aren't of value. We spent a long time talking about, for instance, including a kindergarten readiness indicator as a potential measure, but we didn't feel the evidence, the research that was advanced to us indicated that we were ready for that yet. So it's a worthy goal to reach for, but we think more vetting of potential measures needs to be done among the professionals involved before we might move forward there. But we felt as a group, not with total unanimity, which you'll maybe hear in our discussion, but that all of the measures we're advancing are research-based and have a long psychometric history in terms of being defended as potential measures to be on the report card. So with that background, I'll turn the mic back to Senator Rummel, and we'll proceed, and I look forward to both the presentations and the discussion.
Thank you very much, and I will now turn the discussion over to our two very capable legislative analysts, and they'll walk you through the bill. I hope everyone has had an opportunity to get a copy of it, so I don't know how you two want to handle that. We have Lisa Larson with us and Shelby McQuaid.
Madam Chairs, what I'm proposing to do is to give you a very brief overview of how this bill is structured, and then Ms. McQuaid will go through the sections one by one. What we've got here is a proposal to implement several state accountability indicators that are separate from but not in conflict with the No Child Left Behind Act. And there are essentially right now three indicators being proposed. The first of the three is a student growth indicator that would use data from currently administered MCAs to measure both individual students' educational growth as well as to identify the schools and districts that demonstrate exceptional growth. And these would be schools and districts that not only have demonstrated achievement by whatever state norms exist, but also those that have yet to demonstrate achievement but are making exceptional growth toward that measure of achievement. They are sometimes referred to by legislators as beating the odds schools, but these would be measures both for schools that have not yet achieved the norm as well as those that have exceeded the norms. The second of the three proposed indicators is something we've been referring to in shorthand as a rigorous coursework measure, and there are two components to that measure. The first would be information about the extent to which high school graduates have completed the coursework that is important for post-secondary academic education and career opportunities, but without the need for any kind of remediation. And the second of the two parts of this rigorous coursework measure would indicate the extent to which high school graduates have successfully completed rigorous courses of study and industry certification courses. Finally, the third indicator for this state accountability system has to do with what we've called in shorthand as student safety and engagement. And what this is an indicator that would show students' self-reported sense of school safety, school engagement, and the quality of students' relationship with teachers, administrators, and other students. And just for your information, you may or may not be familiar with our bill drafting conventions, but what you've got here essentially are two parts to the bill. The first part of the bill, through about section, what, seven or so? Changes to the statute themselves. This means that what you see is what's being proposed to amend the current law with respect to accountability. The last number of sections are not codified. That means that they are law, but they would never appear in statute. And they are there to set out the process and the substance of that process for implementing the indicators that are not going to be immediately effective. And with that, Ms. McQuay will go over the sections.
Madam Chairs and members, on page one, the section one is a new, all new language that lays out some of the definitions that are used throughout the legislation. The subdivision six, the state growth norm, in addition to defining what the state growth norm actually includes, how often and who sets the state growth norm. Beginning on 2.8, section 2 is the statewide testing and reporting system, and these changes are mostly technical, but there is a change beginning on 4.33 through 4.35 that clarifies that the value-added system that the legislature is asking the commissioner to include is a growth-based value-added system. Beginning on page 6, the system accountability, there's changes to this section recognizes that there's two systems of accountability and achievement, the federal system and the state system.
Section 4.
On 6.10 and 6.11, the language is included to ensure that this system of accountability promotes, in addition to greater academic achievement, preparation for higher academic education, preparation for the world of work, and responsible citizenship in the arts. Section 4 begins on 7.25. This is the section that lays out the two systems of accountability. The first one in subdivision 2 is the federally mandated system of accountability, the AYP system, and this is where the growth model that the Department of Education is working on would fall into. Subdivision 3, beginning on page 9.4, begins to lay out the system of accountability that the state would like to see. So this includes the growth measure and the other measures, including rigorous coursework and the student engagement measure that Ms. Larson just spoke of. Subdivision 4 is beginning on 10.19 is a section on improving schools. This would require the commissioner to report to the legislature on the best practices learned from those schools demonstrating exceptional growth, or as mentioned earlier, the beat the odds schools. Section 5 begins on 11.9. This is This section lists precisely what is included in the report card. It includes measures that were already listed in legislation and also includes measures that were previously included in the report card but not specifically laid out in legislation. Section 6, then, again, is the value-added assessment program language that is just changed to reflect that the Commissioner of Education is asked to implement a growth-based value-added system as opposed to just a value-added system. It's hopefully a clarifying piece of language. Section 7 then begins what Ms. Larson referred to as the session law. This is just language that helps set up what the measures will be and is not included in statute. Section 7 is the is asking the commissioner to convene a group and report to the legislature on implementing a student growth-based value-added model. Section 8 is the section asking the commissioner to convene a group and report to the legislature on implementing rigorous coursework measures related to student performance. Section 9 does the same thing with implementing the measures for assessing students' sense of safety, school safety, engagement in schools, and the quality of their relationship with teachers, administrators, and other students. And finally, in Section 10, the Minnesota Assessment Group is asked to ensure that the commissioner is using the growth-based value-added model that has been worked out through this past interim. And then the Minnesota Assessment Group is asked to report back to the legislature.
Thank you very much. First, we would like to invite to the table Dr. Michelle Walker? Michelle Walker, who is new to the District of St. Paul School District. And you are their assessment?
Accountability.
You're their accountability person. If you recall, our very first hearing was an overview of the report card, and then we invited a number of superintendents to give us some feedback on how the report card in its current state was working. And we've invited the folks from St. Paul to come and give us their perspective on student achievement and report card issues so that we could take that perspective into account.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chairpersons Rummel and Breinert, and the members of the Joint Senate and House Work Group. My name is Michelle Walker, and I am the Chief Accountability Officer for the St. Paul Public Schools. I am here on behalf of Superintendent Maria Kerstarfin, who could not be here this afternoon. I am also accompanied by Dr. Tom Watkins, our Director of Research, Evaluation, and Assessment, who will also be available to answer any questions you may have. I am pleased to speak before you today on an issue which I believe reflects the high priority that this state places on education. As I compare my experiences working for and with other school districts, most notably Washington, D.C. and New York City, I am optimistic that with the support of this state, St. Paul Public Schools is well poised to close achievement gaps and to continue being a model of high-quality urban education within the state and across the nation. I will focus my remarks today on the value of multiple measures of academic success and the ways that this proposed legislation can support the efforts within St. Paul and the needs of children and parents across the state. In terms of systemic improvement, the No Child Left Behind Act and the state accountability system are intended to improve public education in Minnesota and across this country. The NCLB Act envisions state and district report cards as essential tools for holding schools accountable for student results, as well as engaging families and community members in the education of their children. As we all know, the enterprise of educating our children for the 21st century is complex, and we in St. Paul commend this legislature for recognizing the need for multiple measures. The state report card is viewed by many as the first authoritative source for summary information on schools and district performance. Frankly, what the state publishes about schools matters. Parents and families use this information to make decisions about which schools and districts they will select for their children. And as you have acknowledged, the state report card must present an accurate picture of our schools and districts so that the public can make informed and valuable comparisons. As Minnesota moves forward in developing its next generation of accountabilities for schools, the report card should be refined to reflect our current context. It should help parents make those informed decisions about public education options, all of those that are available to them. St. Paul is known for its history of providing an array of educational options for our parents, and most recently for our efforts to take on a system of improvement and an area of accountability with high expectations. So how do we believe that this legislation supports our efforts? In the fall of 2006, when the voters of St. Paul renewed and expanded our operating referendum, our district made a commitment not only to continue to build upon the success that we've had over the last few years, but also to accelerate achievement for all students, regardless of race, socioeconomic status, gender, and other characteristics. Our strategic plan for continued excellence articulates our priorities to the community and sets forth 12 measures of outcomes that we will look at to judge our success. It raises expectations for all of our students and establishes challenging targets for these indicators through 2011. Being transparent about our successes and our shortcomings is vital to our commitment to the residents. Just as we did this past November, we will continue to publish our own progress report on the implementation of the strategic plan, as well as ways that we are holding ourselves accountable. This report will continue to be the unvarnished truth about the progress as we see it on the indicators that we've selected. In St. Paul, we use apples-to-apples comparisons as a way to make better use of the MCA and MCA2 results. Students are compared to their peers statewide who have the same ethnicity, free and reduced lunch status, English language learner status, and special education status. And this also serves as a meaningful indicator for schools as they interpret the state test results. Student growth on the MCA2 is also an important indicator for us because it accounts for last year's achievement. In the fall, we calculate a growth measure at the district level and conduct workshops with schools so that they will be able to make sense of it and use it for the year. And after combining our apples to apples and our MCA2 growth and all of the other indicators in our strategic plan, we have a more comprehensive picture of our district and each of the schools that we have had before. This array of data enables us to identify and recognize schools that are making comprehensive improvement and, as we've discussed already, beating the odds. Failing to recognize this collection of improvement has been one of the most significant failures of NCLB and, to date, the current report card. So we are looking forward to the recommended changes to address these issues. The discussion around establishing state growth norms for student groups and providing district and school comparisons have been promising. We've participated in many of those discussions, and we look forward to working with the legislature and MDE to ensure that we come up with a system that is workable and provides a valuable source of information for our parents and our families. With regard to the advanced coursework portion of the bill, our strategic plan also allows us to focus on ensuring high school graduates are ready for post-secondary coursework and that they have every option available to them to allow them to graduate. For example, last October, we wanted to make sure that students were taking examinations to help them be prepared for the college experience, and so we ensured that all of our 11th graders had the opportunity to take the PSAT at least once for free at their home school. And our preliminary analysis indicates that the participations of participation of students who took the exam increased from 24% in 2006 to over 70% last year, exceeding our own district target of 39%. Completion of rigorous advanced coursework is an excellent proxy to measure progress on this outcome, and the St. Paul Public Schools supports its inclusion in the revised report card. We want to commend the legislature for not only recognizing the importance of academic growth and student progress as key indicators of success, but also for its focus on student safety and engagement. We, too, have been working to ensure that all of our schools are safe and welcoming environments, not just for our students and our families, but also for our employees. We have begun to develop measures and survey tools to look at how we're doing on this goal. And we hope that the state will draw from and further support these efforts, as well as those of other districts that are also exploring the same issues. As these discussions continue, we ask that you please consider the impact of the additional data collection requirements of any other indicators that may be considered. New survey tools, new required assessments, new reporting requirements all come with some direct or indirect costs. So as we face declining enrollment, as we look at revenue shortfalls potentially, and as we address some of the mandates that already exist, we hope that and we trust that when we move forward, our legislature will support the appropriate resources needed to implement any changes. I thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. We are excited about the great efforts that are currently underway to support schools and districts in our delivery of high-quality public education. We look forward to further discussions with you about the specific elements of the bill as you move to final adoption. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ms. Walker. Are there questions or comments? Representative Brainerd.
Thank you, Senator Rommel. Comment, I really just appreciate the depth of your response at such short notice to our proposal. And clearly we are aware that any additional data requirements have implications. And we actually, in that respect, have tried to, again, as I mentioned, be somewhat conservative in terms of the requirements that we're proposing, and that the data is currently readily available to some extent and wouldn't require creating a whole new database. Now, that, in terms of the student engagement measure, that's another issue. But we have tried to allow in the structure of the legislation ample room for exploring that, both the choosing and the application there, so that we aren't creating unfair additional testing burdens, and that the gain of the information balances the demand.
We do appreciate that. Thank you.
I have a couple of questions, if it's all right. First of all, I'm curious about your apples to apples and MCA growth. Do you then take your own data and pull it out with and compare it with other schools based on the MCA 2s? Is that what you mean by your apples to apples?
Yes, that's correct, but I'll ask Dr. Watkins to explain more specifically.
Chair Rommel and members of the
Welcome,
committee.
Dr. Watkins.
Essentially, what happens with apples to apples, we have a couple of different ways that we've done this analysis. One way is to use the student level, and so to just take a student's individual score and compare that student with comparable students statewide. And so we can actually determine with the available state data what the comparable student average is. And so we can compare at the student level, and then we can also compare at the school level. So taking a school average, let's say, for Asian American, non-ELL, low-income special education students, and compare that average with the state average. And so that's what we've called an apples-to-apples comparison, and it's really not quite as complete as having a growth measure, mm-hmm. And so it's been something that we've used in the years leading up to where we are now. But it has been very helpful for us to get a sense for making sense of the status level. And then to keep that transparent so that people can actually see how it's calculated.
And what are you finding out?
With the apples-to-apples comparisons, we find that there are some groups within our district that compare very favorably with their peers statewide. In other words, if we look at Asian American students who are ELL, and that's a, as you can guess, that's a large portion of our population, they'll generally outperform their peers statewide. And that's been encouraging. Caucasian students who are non-free reduced lunch and non-ELL will also compare very favorably to their peers statewide, just as a couple of examples. And so that's one of the things that's kind of helped us to get a sense for, well, okay, the performance is good, the populations are different in these different schools, but we do have a reference point that we can look at. And so, again, with the growth measures, that's going to give us a much more complete picture.
And then you mentioned that you were using some of your own measures or creating some measures for student safety reporting. Can you talk to us a little bit about what you're doing?
Sure. Pardon. In our strategic plan, one of our indicators with that was that we would create safe and welcoming environments. So right now, actually Dr. Watkins is involved in that too. We're going through a process where we're going to develop a tool that we would use annually to survey specific populations, initially students, then parents and community members, to ask how are they experiencing the St. Paul Public Schools and whether or not we are meeting the goals that we've set out. And the process involves us doing focus groups first to identify what the issues are that we should be asking about and then developing the tools. So I don't know if you have anything else to add to that, but
it certainly sounds like your transparent your own report card goes above and beyond what we're doing here, obviously. And I did see it, and the your superintendent has got to be commended for the strategic plan. So it seems like what we're doing here is very small compared to all the efforts you're already making.
Well, what I would say to that, Senator, is that I think that your efforts will actually complement what we're doing, and that I think it will raise even more beyond what the district has been saying, the importance of the issue. It will allow schools to have a comparable way of looking at their success at the state level as well. So it doesn't seem like we're being particularly onerous on our schools and our student and populations, but that this is the trend that we're looking at opportunities, not just for one examination, but to look at many ways that we are benefiting the educational experience. So I think it's a good complement, that as well as the other activities that we've been involved with the department around growth for our NCLB status as well. So I think that all of them can work together, but we are at the district level saying that there are many things that we value, and of those few things, we will measure them and we will continue to report to our constituents our success on them in a very frank way.
Well, thank you both very much. Excuse me, Senator Weaker.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the presentation. Do you have any data on the amount of parents that do refer to the report card, and particularly parents that may have at-risk students and that population, and how actively do they navigate that information and provide that? And is the primary source online or is it written? What feedback do you have on that?
I'm not sure if we have gotten sophisticated enough to collect data on exactly whether the parents are looking at the report card more so than our information. But on our website, we have a data center that has a lot of information on student performance and would be sort of the primary source of where parents would go to look at how their children are doing. We also have links to the department site on our website. But I'm not sure, and Dr. Watkins can correct me, whether or not we've been able to assess how frequently they go to the state report card versus some of the information that we've given them. And we've just started workshops to actually help parents know what data is available, how do they use that information. For example, at our parent information fair this past weekend, we had a station to just help our families know how to navigate the tools that already exist and where to find the information. But
the only piece I would add to that is just that, and I'm sure that a lot of you have noticed this as well, the amount of information that is out there that's available to parents is absolutely overwhelming. It's incredibly challenging to try to navigate through it, even for people who know the system quite well. So I
thanks really, for admitting that.
I do think that, you know, we are in a position here where we need to keep that in mind, and we want to think of just the basic kind of information that people would need to inform decision-making and how we can help them with that. And then also have, you know, the more in-depth information available for people who want that. But, you know, they shouldn't have to dig quite so much as I think the situation is now.
To piggyback on that question then, and I don't want to put you on a spot right now because I'd like you to think about it. Are there things on the report card, this is what we asked at the first hearing, that you think we do not need for the parent and public purposes? I have no intention of in any way hiding data from those of you who need the data to do the sophisticated analysis you do. But for the use of parents and the public, what are the most useful things for you? So is there a way I would really welcome any help on how we can simplify this document so that you don't have to do as much work as you do have to do to make it useful to parents.
Sure, and we can certainly go back and look at the feedback that we've received on the information that we're currently providing. What are the things that parents find more overwhelming than not, and that might inform our recommendations to you around the report
card. That would be really
well.
Helpful, really helpful. Is there any... anything else? Representative Norton.
Senator Rummel, I appreciate you asking that question, and it's one I've been asking as we've been moving along here, and I actually have kind of put an all-call out through the OAP to see if I could get some information back, and they thought perhaps within the next month they couldn't do it prior to the start of session. They couldn't get it by the 12th, they didn't think, but within the next few weeks, I'm hoping to have some information from real parents to find out, have they ever used it before? If they use it, is it too much? Is there a way, a simplified, something that could be simplified or something missing that would be really valuable? And so hopefully I can provide some feedback. I know it'll be after the fact, but I'll provide the committee feedback as I get it.
That will be terrific. Thank you so much, Representative mm-hmm. Norton. And thank you both for coming, and we hope to hear from you soon.
Thank you.
The centerpiece of our proposal of our legislation is really the growth model. It's what we've been hearing about the most, and for many of us, it's the part that's most confusing. So we're inviting Dr. Heisted to come back to us and explain to us what he means, what he's proposing, what he thinks. And mostly I'm curious about what will show up on the report card. What will the average parent and public person see on the report card? So, and Dr. Heisted has given us hours and hours of his time. We so appreciate it. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Senator Rummel. Legislators, I planned just a short presentation today, but I'd like to answer any questions that you have. The main target of my testimony today would be the rationale for including a growth indicator in the state report card. Why is it important to have a true growth indicator in addition to what we already have from No Child Left Behind? And then to answer maybe some of these practical questions as well. Now, in Minneapolis, we've been using a multiple measure report card of sorts for the last 12 years, and it includes far many more indicators than we would propose for the state report card. We have between 30 and 40 indicators on the elementary, middle school, and high school, but they're different versions, and so the version that the school teams use, leadership teams, is quite detailed, and it is fairly sophisticated, but using the same format for 12 years, the teams have really gotten used to it. But we distill it down to a one- or two-page letter that goes home to the community. So the each individual school takes the data and adds some narrative and sends it off. And that, I think, is much more readable for parents. And then we do have an online source. And before we had the online school information report, we'd have 300 or 400 requests for paper copies from our community. So we know what the paper copies were helpful, but when we went to the online, I think it was a lot easier for those that had the ability to access it electronically. The main reason we went to a multiple measure system for achievement was that the typical way that the data were being reported year after year to the school board and to the public was sort of the No Child Left Behind approach. We had the California Achievement Test. It was given every year, and we reported the percentage of students that were above average, you know, compared to the national norms on just that point in time. And what we saw, the district when I started was approximately 35% students in poverty, and less than half of the students were students of color. And as the district became more diverse and we had more students who were English language learners and more students from impoverished backgrounds, those average test scores would go down every year. And it just, was a constant source of pain for the school board and administrators. But when we started asking, well, how much did the students who stay with us for even 1 year, how much progress do those students make over the course of that year? We found that even though the average test scores were going down as the demographics of the students coming in was changing, the gain scores are actually quite good, especially for some schools. That's how we got into the Beat the Odds model, and I think it's the chief rationale for including both achievement level, as No Child Left Behind has indicated that we need to do, and also a true growth model. The problems with the achievement level only and reporting that across time, I think Dr. Mark Davison helped out with the definitions that are at the beginning of the bill. What I would refer to is the definition of progress, where it says progress compares the average achievement of two different groups of students at two different points in time. That's pretty much the No Child Left Behind model that we have with us right now. That's comparing this year's third graders to last year's third graders. So it's a different point in time. It's two different groups of students. And the reason that that's inadequate is that we know that third grade students' test scores include all of the history that child has perhaps before birth, all the way to third grade. So we can't really say for sure that it was the child's experience in third grade that was responsible for that score. That's one of the problems, is that the improvement or lack thereof could have been way before the test was given. A second one is that the score is not localized to the building. And so because we don't necessarily have a pretest and a post-test on that same student, we don't know if it was another school or another point in time that caused the differences. It's especially problematic since we have mobility in our schools. Some districts, St. Paul and Minneapolis especially, have very high mobility. And if the student population is not the same from third grade last year to third grade this year, we have a problem. It may look like the achievement has gone down, but in actuality, if we look just at the students that were enrolled throughout that year, the achievement might actually be accelerating. So we might be mislabeling a large percentage of schools using the AYP approach of this year's third graders to last year. That's the rationale for why we really need a multiple measure system that includes growth as well as level. And I have an analogy that I sometimes use to the Minnesota Twins or to a baseball team. I used to play baseball in college. So if you had a hitting coach, for example, for the Twins, you would expect that the team would be improving in their batting average from one year to another. And, in fact, you might have the average Twins batting average go from 260 to 280 in one year. But if you don't look at where the Twins batters started at the beginning of the year, you might attribute great growth to the batting coach when, in fact, he recruited Rod Carew, Kirby Puckett, and Wade Boggs to be on the team. So if you get a lot of high average ball players recruited to your school, it's going to affect your average score. So that's just an example of why you actually have to see how we did with those rookie batters at the beginning of the year and whether they're doing better at the end of the year. That's the basic testimony that I wanted to give, was the rationale for the growth model. And then I'm glad to answer any specific question. Well, I know one specific question that has come up with the growth model is whether we would be re-establishing the baseline for the state norms every year. And that would not be the recommendation of our subgroup. We really think that we could stay with the same baseline of last year's growth compared to this to the year before for individual students, take that norm and keep that the same as long as we have the same progress score used by the state. So until we completely change the metric, we could keep that same norm. And then theoretically, 100% of the schools could be making more than a year's growth. So we'd have to change when we change the metric. But, for example, in NWA, they haven't changed the metric for 30 years. So we've been able to track achievement gain against the norms. But they do renorm every 3 to 5 years. So we have to make a decision whether we're going to change the baseline or not. I know that was one question. But there may be others, specific questions that you have.
Representative Brainerd.
Thank you, Senator Rummel. Dr. Heistad, we've talked in various committees about achievement gap measures. What, in your judgment, would this growth model contribute to that discussion?
Well, I think it would be a true measure of achievement gap as opposed to the progress approach to achievement gap. Again, you can be misled by having a group of students come into your district that have different starting levels of achievement. And it is also problematic if you're measuring, for example, the difference between African American performance and white American performance, if the top group comes down and the gap is narrowed by that top group coming down, that's not a success. But we want to make sure that all groups of students are making progress, the same kids across time, and that the students that are the furthest behind make the greatest progress. And so a true gain measure helps you know for sure that the gap has been decreased, whereas the progress approach that compares different kids across time, you can be misled into believing that the gap is closing when it may not be. We use the gain scores on the NWA to show whether our gaps are increasing, because it gives us a very good picture of starting point and ending point, and see if the difference between the lines is getting bigger versus the top group is making growth, the bottom group is making even more growth, and there the gaps are really big. I really need an overhead, don't I? But you get the idea. The group on the bottom is making greater growth than the group at the top, but the group at the top is also making gains.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask a number of questions because I have talked to some people out in the field a little bit, and partly maybe my ignorance about how this will. I'm going back to our first intent was to create something that would be useful to the school districts, to parents, that would inform them about what's going on in their schools. And I'm envisioning, and I may have this wrong, so forgive me if I misinterpret it, On the report card, there will be an AYP, school did or did not make mm-hmm. annual yearly progress. And then how will we be reporting your recommended growth model? What will mm-hmm. what will that look like?
One picture that we presented at the last hearing was a spreadsheet that had percentage of students making state norm growth or better, broken up by the categories. The eight No Child Left Behind categories plus gender. So that's one possibility would be you'd see the state, what percentage of the students made state norm growth by each of the groups, and you would see your own school. And that would be, it could be just the overall percentage at the first level and click on it to get the breakdown of all the groups, or it could be all that information on one page. But I could envision that there would be a committee to determine something like a blue ribbon school status that would look what, schools across the state are doing in terms of growth and establishing some kind of a criteria for these are schools that we want to really make special note of, we want to go visit, find out what they're doing, et cetera. But on the report card itself, it could be a graph. I like graphs better than tables that could show what percentage made state norm growth comparing the various
And this
groups.
Would be the growth over a year?
It would be a 1 year. It would be the from last year's spring testing till this year's spring testing. And then you would compare that to the state norm established. We've already done it for the 7th to 8th grade growth. It would be the 2006-2007. That would be your state norm until you create a new test and new measures.
So then maybe it's my mistake because I thought I heard you say it the last time you spoke that you would have a number for the average growth in this state, and mm-hmm. then you would, not a percent, but a number, 10 points, 12 mm-hmm. points on that progress mm-hmm. score. And then you would show for the district or the school whether they were above or below that number. But you're saying no. It would be the percent
it that would be the
gets
percentage
that or
of
more.
Students is what I think is easier to understand than the average scale score. And actually, that whole calculation would be behind the scenes.
Okay.
What the state norm is for your child, given their starting point last year, and how you did versus that state norm, would not appear. It would just be the percentage of students.
That makes more sense to me, and I'm the one that was confused.
We've tried it both ways in Minneapolis, and we've found that the percentage of students, and we call it making a year's growth in a year's period of time, and we equate that to making national norm growth. We avoided using that term, 1 year's growth for a year's period of time, simply because there are a number of different definitions of what 1 year's growth might be. We just said state norm growth. But in Minneapolis, we use that interchangeably. It's basically typical growth versus, what your student's growth was.
And so what would be on the report card would be the school's growth, mm-hmm. not the individual students.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would be percentage of students that made a year's growth or more, state norm growth or more, and then you could see whether that percentage changes across time. The most useful part of it is you've got your own baseline and you can see your own progress. Mm-hmm. In Minneapolis, we had schools that started with only 40% of African American students making national norm growth, and now we're up to 60%. So you can track your progress just like you can track your percent proficient, and hopefully both are going up, the percent proficient and the growth.
Do you think there is a difference in cohorts of students from year to year?
Yeah, in fact, that is the main reason why the current No Child Left Behind doesn't work very well is that last year's third graders may be completely different from this year's third graders. Certainly at a classroom level, all teachers know that. You just get the Johnson triplets in there, and all of a sudden the scores change. And that can actually happen at a whole school level. Several schools that were on the AYP list for the first time won awards from the district for making exceptional growth. They had huge changes in their population for their third graders coming in. Back then, we only had third and fifth grade students tested. And if you happen to get a low group of students moving into third and fifth grade, and you also saw at that point huge jumps in the percent proficient from year to year. And again, it's due to these cohort effects that you get a group of students coming in that are exceptional, doing very well, and then the next year you have a typical performing group. So the gains even that out because you figure out where they start, where they end, and you compare that to what typical progress is for every student. So it doesn't bounce around from year to year like the
And then going back to Ms. Walker's comment about not burdening the schools, how do mm-hmm. How will we be getting this information? Will the schools be calculating mm-hmm. this or the
no,
department? Or?
Kathy Wagner would be doing it. No. her team, in fact, she's already asked me for the algorithms for how you do this. But it would be completely behind the scenes. And so similar to the reports that come out with No Child Left Behind, there would be a report put in on the website and made available a paper copy that would give the summary. It is actually quite doable.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I heard you address a potential blue ribbon school as something off into the future, not something we're talking about.
Well, without having actual data on school performance across the state, it'd be difficult for me to come up with an arbitrary number. I found over the years that in Minneapolis, if schools are having 60% of their students making national norm growth for African-American students, it's quite good. There aren't very many that are getting 60 or 70%. So we've set standards for growth in Minneapolis, but I think you'd have to have the real data to be able to look at it. And I think it would be, you know, broad representation group that could make those determinations. And again, since you have a multiple measure system, you might want to incorporate the other indicators as well into such a thing. And whether that's just an idea, but if you wanted to boil it down to 10, 12 schools that really made exceptional progress in mathematics and same in reading, you'd have to have a team deciding what that criteria was.
And I guess I was looking to see if you were suggesting that that the state do that, and I guess I was – it sounds like it's mm-hmm. out further, which I think is mm-hmm. wise, because we already have parents confused
yeah.
with one layer. Mm-hmm. We're going to add a second, and right. frankly, in my district, I can think of several yeah. schools who might be blue ribbon in growth and – or blue ribbon in growth but not in the other. I mean, yeah. so you could have a – very contradictory mm-hmm. reflections, which would just cause confusion. So we either need yeah. to meld them together or give this more thought.
We as a subgroup, we're recommending that we just report the data the first year without
yep.
any big interpretation of it. And
that's
we
great.
Might want to have a determination based on two consecutive years because there is some change from year to year. If you see, for example, a teacher that beats the odds the first year, they may not be the second year, but when we see it two consecutive mm-hmm. years, then I'm sure that's a teacher that's really a very strong performance.
And the example I would think of is a school who might currently be a blue ribbon mm-hmm. school, if you will, mm-hmm. on the adequate yearly mm-hmm. progress, and yet when we're going to yeah. show growth, they're going to not show yeah. the kind of, they're going to show average or below average, and mm-hmm. how do you explain to the yeah. consumer that they're blue ribbon here and, I don't know, a red light, you know, on the other one. So I appreciate the fact that we're going to wait on that and just
that would
scores.
Be our recommendation.
Yeah. yeah. Thank you.
Representative Breiner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment on that, Representative Norton. I think we removed the five stars for just some of the reasons we're talking about here, and I think we would be very cautious about moving to a system of rewards. But I think prior to that, one of the real gains from this that we talked about quite a bit as this model was shaped is the use of this to identify best practice and actually move forward continuous improvement models, you know. So, and from my perspective, that's a higher value. know, and I think we can move to that reasonably quickly. But Dr. Heistad, you might want to comment on that.
Yeah, I think it would be excellent to have some funding dedicated for researchers to follow up on these schools that are making exceptional progress. We found it extremely helpful in Minneapolis to have examples of our own teachers with best practices videotaping with their permission and the parents' permission, and then sharing that as staff development. So there are all sorts of possibilities for following up.
I have one more question. I don't want to get too deep into the weeds, but when we were speaking about the MCA's capability and flexibility at the upper end of achievement and at the lower end of achievement, the MCAs are rather blunt instruments. Am I correct?
Well, because they're set up to measure standards, and they don't have the adaptive nature of the NWA, where you can go out of level and go way up or way down, they do have a problem with a floor and a ceiling. So there are a lot of students that get all the answers correct, and there are a lot of students that are at chance guessing. So with an adaptive assessment, whether it would be the NWA or any other vendor, it allows you then to custom the questions to where the student is at. So if they're getting them all right, they start getting tougher questions, and eventually, you know, they may get something wrong. You have to warn these children that you may actually get a few answers wrong. And for the children that are two or three grade levels below, you really give them a much better experience taking the test, as well as much better information for teachers and for parents about their true level of performance. So there is that advantage. But as we mentioned before, the current federal guidelines don't allow for use of the adaptive test.
And I understand that,
yes.
But I'm just looking at when you start dealing with gains and score, you have very little to deal with in those two populations.
It is problematic. You do actually have, you know, when you have students getting 100% correct, some of that may be due to chance. And so students might have guessed on three and got all three right. The next time they guess on three, they only get one out of three right. And so there's something called regression to the mean, where the scores tend to go down. So the expected growth may actually be negative for the kids that are way up at the top. And the expected growth for kids that have totally guessed on everything, they probably are going to do a little bit better the next time. So it is problematic, but we felt as a group that we shouldn't wait until the No Child Left Behind laws are changed. We should actually use our assessments, which are very high quality. The MCAs are very high quality assessments. They just weren't designed to measure growth the way the NWAs were.
And so are you and your colleagues helping, are you going to help us frame what recommendations we want to send to Washington for the next edition of what comes next?
The commissioner has been very, very open in having members of the academic community as well as different constituencies, and we meet monthly to do that. So, yes, I think we will be able to shape something. The other growth model that's being used for No Child Left Behind was a group that put together a recommendation based on the best impact for Minnesota. And so I think that's what we would do with this as the law changes, is take advantage of the flexibility, if there is flexibility.
We're losing.
Any other questions? Thank you again, Dr. Heistad. This has been very helpful. I'd like to call to the table now Dr. Mariyama. And Dr. Mariyama is from the University of Minnesota, and he helped us on the rigorous coursework portion of this bill. Welcome to the table. And again, thank you for all that you've done to help us get where we are today.
Senator Rummel, Representative Bryan, and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity. I am at the university, but I'm not here representing the university, so certainly what I say is not the opinion of the University of Minnesota. But I'm here actually trying to represent the views of the rigorous coursework working group. And from that group, you have two recommendations in front of you. One of them is about patterns of coursework taken, and the pattern that's set at the threshold is what's required to for admission to the four-year public institutions in the state of Minnesota. The second one is a measure of college-level course taking, and those are courses that can yield post-secondary education credits. In some ways, it's a measure of breadth. So if you were to say, what does that mean? So the first measure is what percent of the graduates have taken the courses needed to admit them to a four-year public institution in the state of Minnesota. For the second one, it's what percent of the graduates have at least one class that's a college-level and potentially college credit-bearing class before they graduate from high school. With respect to background, earlier Ken Pickell talked about the Toolbox Revisited and Answers in the Toolbox, the work of Adelman. And basically, his work found that academic intensity of coursework counts more than anything else in providing momentum towards degrees. And he noted that at the high bar, they said 95% of the students actually get four-year degrees. Now, that actually includes 4 years of math, so it's higher than the bar that we set. But course taking is certainly a strong predictor. And math actually is the best content area predictor, math attainment. Within the University of Minnesota, rigorous course taking is probably the most important thing in admissions. Now, this actually touches both of those particular areas because our students are supposed to meet number one as a threshold, but then in addition, the advanced course taking that they take is what shows us that they're ready for college success. You know, we've looked earlier, Craig Schoenecker from MinSCU talked about a study we're doing for the P16 partnership looking at remedial or developmental course taking. And that in that particular research, I mean, we're not finding what's not surprising. The more courses, this is in mathematics, the more courses you take, the less your chance of taking remedial courses in it. But just taking those courses isn't enough. So this is sort of the number one is really sort of a necessary but not sufficient hurdle for not having, for being prepared for college. And the language actually is worded that way because what we find is if you look at students who've gotten a grade of B or better in their classes, in their highest class, you see then a much slower percent of them who are taking remedial courses or developmental courses. So it's one thing to take the course, but if you come out competent, you're going to do a lot better than if you slide by. with respect to preparing the second part, preparing students, giving them college-level classes, one of the things that we've looked for is there's a certain top tier of students who take those classes, and those kids are going to go to college and succeed. We're hopeful that more and more students will start taking those classes because what it does is gives them an opportunity to experience a rigorous college-level class. I mean, we have high standards, and yet there's students who come to our university and the Twin Cities campus, and they'll be almost all the way through the first semester, and they'll have, and the syllabus will say 25% of your grade is the first mid-semester class, the grade course test, 25% is quizzes, 25% is the second mid-semester test, and 25% is the final. They'll have 75% basically done, and they'll have a D, and they'll come in and say, well, what does it take to get a B in this class? We want them to know that before they get there, to realize you can't fall way behind and expect to catch up, because when the syllabus says these are what you're going to be graded on, that's what you're graded on. So giving students the experience to have a college-level class is really important. A second part of that, going back to that toolbox revisited, they say a key for college graduation is successful completion of gateway classes. And the gateway classes are the basic survey or entry-level classes and then maybe a second tier. A lot of the classes that would fall under number two are the gateway classes. So students can come into college already having completed gateway classes, or even if they haven't completed the class, if they haven't gotten credit or they want to start in that class, at least they come in well prepared for the gateway class. So one of the things that's important about looking at the college level course taking is it gives you information about how ready kids are to get the kinds of classes they need that'll move them on towards graduation. One of the things that we've looked at is the percent of our students who come in with college credits. And I don't think this will surprise you to know. And I'm looking at the class, entering class of fall 2003, which is one we've done a lot of work on since it's now 4 years in. 50% of our freshmen had college credits. The median number of credits, you know, skewed, some kids have a real lot of credits, but the middle number of credits that students had was 12 for those who had credits. And the average across all students, if you know, take the number of credits, divide by our 5,400 entering students, it's still 8.5. So if you come in with no credits to the University of Minnesota, you're behind your peer group. So you know, I think it's important for parents to know when they have their, when they look at their high school choices, whether or not the kids are taking the classes. One other thing that's important is Craig Swan, our former vice provost, who's just retired, has looked at how does the credits at entry compare to credits at exit, that how many fewer credits does the student need, and he found it's about half. For every credit you come in with, you take a half less credit on your way to graduation. So we know there's a relationship between coming in with credits and finishing, and the amount of time it takes you to finish. One other thing I might mention is that simplicity was sort of the rule and comprehensibility to parents, but I would like to sort of put a bug in your ear for two other things that we discussed that I think are important. The first one is I mentioned that having a student, the percent of students who take one or more classes is a measure of breadth. What percent of the kids in the school at least have an advanced class? But another measure would be a measure of depth. Of those students who have advanced classes, how many are they taking? Are they only taking one? Are they taking five or six? Are they taking eight? I think that's an important thing to know as you look at a high school, to know, is my kid going to get many of these classes and these kinds of opportunities? Then the fourth measure, going again back to the toolbox, they talk about provision of curriculum. They say some kids go to schools where there's not a lot of advanced courses offered, and they won't have the opportunities others will. So the fourth potential measure would be one that just says, how many of these advanced classes is this school offering? And what it would do is it would give you a sense to see how kids are doing compared to the opportunities they have. It also would be important, I think, for small schools where it's really hard for them to offer a lot of advanced classes to realize, well, we don't have a lot of students taking them, but given our school size, we can't offer that many sections because we simply don't have the resources to let class sizes get that small. So that's sort of the first part. There's one other thing I suppose I might comment on, and that's in the latter part we talk about, there's a recommendation that says we'd like to be able to look at high schools in terms of who the students are to come to them. In effect, kind of a similar school comparison, that it would be nice to be able to say, you know, of schools like yours, the typical school is having, say, 60% of the students meet this requirement A, and your school has done 40, your school has done 80, your school has done 60, and it's done through technical adjustments, so you don't really need a lot of other schools that are exactly the same as that school. In there, it talks about eighth grade test scores, it talks about mobility of the school, it talks about attendance, and then it talks about a number of set of other indicators. I've been thinking some about that, and the one shortcoming of including all those indicators is you could argue that what it does is it sets different expectations for kids from different backgrounds. So if, in fact, this is done, and I'd hope it would be, one way to modify it would be to say it would be nice if you see how well you can predict by using the eighth grade test scores and the mobility, and maybe the attendance, although the school can control that, but potentially start with eighth grade test scores and mobility and see if you can't build reasonably good models off those variables alone so you're not setting different expectations for different types of kids. So that covers what I think I wanted to say, unless I forgot something.
Representative Briner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Mariama, I'm taking what you just said in the last few sentences to be a recommendation for an amendment to your original proposal in the layout of the measuring.
I think so. I think that a reasonable way to say, for people who oppose this, it would be reasonable to say we don't want to set different expectations for different types of kids. And so let me qualify that a little bit. If you can build reasonable prediction models off those variables, and I think you can, then only use eighth grade test scores and mobility. But look at those others as well, because if they are producing dramatically different graduation or readiness rates, college readiness rates, then I think we need to look at that. We need to figure out what's going on with kids from that demographic. And I think you'll probably see that as you disaggregate those other measures as well. Remember, one of the parts of the first thing is report an overall thing, but also report disaggregations, kind of consistent with NCLB of groups of 20 or more, the disaggregation, so you can see how different subgroups are doing. And that would probably show what you'd find through this.
Would it be possible, Dr. Mariama, to, you know, for individual schools to drill down and get that kind of data? For that sounds like the kind of data that our school experts are using and our teachers mm-hmm. are using, whereas what we need on the report card is something that we can readily explain to parents and will help parents have at least some grasp of what their schools are doing.
Right. And that's why, I mean, the indicator three would be, you know, the how many of such courses does a typical student, you know, typical student taking advanced courses have for this, within the school. So I think that's still relatively understandable. And I think number four, if it were just how many courses are available in the school, is understandable. I'm sorry, it's sort of with respect to as long as those are the indicators, the other underlying stuff is simply stuff that people could use to contextualize those four indicators. And so, I mean, you wouldn't have to have that baseline is something. I mean, I guess schools would probably want it. They would have it, and I suppose it's up to them to figure out how to use it. So if I come up with 40% of my students who are completing the benchmark A, the first one of the courses, and people say, well, you're low, but well, we're low, but we do well compared to other schools that look like us, I guess that could be something they could use. You wouldn't necessarily have to put that into the report card, although, I mean, I think that's something that could be worked out with the schools. How do we want to use those things? I'm sorry, sort of a convoluted way of answering.
Right.
I mean, I think the basic information you can keep fairly simple, and all the drill downs do get a lot more complicated. But this, comparing a school to similar schools is an important thing, but it's inherently technical, and so making people understand it maybe isn't worth putting it in as an indicator, but having it there so schools could use it to explain or help explain why they how they view their information. Kind of, in some ways, like Dave had talked about when he said, you know, we can be low, but if we're coming up, it's important that people know that even though the NCLB might say we're low, that we're making great growth. And it's the same thing. We may look low compared to other schools, but those schools are not like us in terms of the characteristics of the students to whom they're serving.
Representative Briner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would request, Dr. Mariama, that you put that recommendation in writings,
sure,
and that we maybe there may be some for joint discussion with the department about the particular model for projection that you're proposing, so
sure,
that we really have that in a way that has clarity for but I understand what you're saying, and I actually appreciate it. I think the simpler approach is probably has greater merit at this point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I think we have to be very clear, you know, as we're writing the law, so that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And also, I would like to again reference what Ms. Walker referenced to us. You know, how much of a burden are we placing on the schools, and how much of a burden are we placing on the department? You know, we have to think about all of those things. And then, my ultimate goal is that we have a tool that parents and the public will find useful with, and if they need more, the various people who use this data, that they can get it somewhere. It doesn't necessarily have to all be on the report card.
Yes, Senator, I think from my perspective that the statistical stuff that we're talking about, since it's school level, it's information that's in the MARS data, so it's there in the file, and so using it to generate prediction based on entering characteristics shouldn't be hard. It would require following, you know, linking up an entry cohort to a graduating cohort.
I would have to learn more about that. Are there other questions? Dr. Mariama, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Our third testifier on school climate could not come tonight, and then we had a stand-in person, and that person could not come tonight. So I don't have much to share with you in addition to what you see in the bill in terms of the measurement for safety and school engagement. I do have an email from Dr. Jenny Norlin Weaver, who has examined the bill as it is currently written, and she thinks that it captures well the intent of the group that she led, and that she sees that the she's pleased to see that there is specific language regarding the support of the Office of Education Accountability. So what I would like now to do is shift our gears, and we're doing well on time. It's only 5:30. And
there is an event tonight.
No, I didn't. You have to go somewhere.
I don't know. If you want to leave, I think that's reasonable.
Did you want to go somewhere?
There's a conflict. There is another event tonight at the end.
I'll just excuse myself.
Okay. Well, we only have open testimony now.
Okay.
So I don't know if anybody is prepared for open testimony. Wanted to make some comments on what we did for the bill. We realize you haven't had a lot of time to work with it, or to. I'm hoping you will bring it back to your constituent groups and go over it so that you can get back to us and tell us what works or doesn't work, what makes sense or doesn't make sense. But if there is anyone who does wish to address the group, this would be the time. Mr. Coop? Or is it Dr. Coop?
5 minutes.
We're going to give you 5 minutes.
It won't take that long, but it's just a few preliminary impressions or comments, really.
Thank you.
And commendations, mostly commendations, because I think you're going in great directions with a lot of this. And these are going to be around a little bit, but one of the tricky things about the, and I think Mariama was trying to fix some of this with 3 and 4, is that you're mixing value-added measures with level of achievement.
Dr. Coop, we need you to state your name for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Jeff, Dr. Doctor. I'm Jeff Kuhn. It's without my middle initial and whatever. It's K-O-O-N.
Thank you.
Anyway, it's a problem to grapple with, and in fact, you raised the question at one point, I think, in one form or another, about the value added versus not in this, in the same kind of context. And how do you merge those two? Because you can do measures applicable to the high school level. We're in a regression analysis with controls, and I think Mariama mentioned this. For 8th grade reading and math, how much did the high school contribute based on, for example, either the course taken, the number of courses, not the percentage probably, but the average number of advanced courses taken, probably not the college courses because there's going to be few of those. But you could do that with the plan. You can do that with the ACT test too, although it's only going to cover 70% of your students as a measure of high school growth. And once you control for when the kids, how the kids were in eighth, you get a measure of value added for the high school. Anyway, the point is those things are possible, and the mixture of the two gives you some degree of confusion. And one of the keys to the parent, if they're picking a school, is, and the school isn't too high up, is how well do they differentiate instruction at this school? If I got a high achieving kid going into a diddly school, do they service my kind of people well too? Your movement in a survey direction is great. I've done a lot of survey work, junior survey at Central High School for 8 consecutive years. Surveyed 25 different sets of parents and students and so forth in schools in St. Paul over the years for the principals. One thing you could also think about, and I'm going to try to bring you one copy of my study on this, is student evaluations of teaching at the high school level. You're not going to find it in heavily proven measures except at the college level, but there are firms out there that do it, and I've done it at Central High. And we compared the student ratings with the principal's ratings. We got a correlation coefficient out of it. Generally, they're pretty valid. I took 3 different ways of looking at the overall view of the teacher from those surveys, and they combined to say that it's valid within, too. So what I'm saying is you can't mandate it and stick in a report card, but one of the things you could do is set $100,000 aside for anybody who want any schools that want to do it at $1 a kid. And that's one way to drive your high school improvement forward. And it's one that's not generally acknowledged. That's really all. And I'm sorry it was so scattered, but I'll try to bring more of it together over time or something for you as things develop and as I get a chance to read through more.
Thank you, Dr. Kuhn. Anyone else? Any questions? Would anyone else like to bring something to our attention? Going. Oops. Representative Breiner?
Just a brief comment on the what's called school climate on our agenda. You can see from the legislation that that indicator is much broader than that. It's school safety, climate, student engagement, and it's meant to be, I mean, we will have discussion about this, and it'll be laid out on a more research basis, but there is a wealth of research that these areas are predictive of student success and that they are very connected to student achievement, and Dr. Heistad could probably comment on that, but I think it's an area we absolutely have to engage as a state, but we want to do so at the highest professional level and vet the instrument or whatever. It could be as simple, we've had within our discussion, it could be as simple as five questions added to the MCAs, if that's the direction we want to go, but there are questions we need to be able to answer. And they do make a difference. And the research, there's at least a dozen research documents in this arena. So I'm anxious to engage that discussion when we have the opportunity, when the bill is vetted at the next, you know, maybe when it's first heard in the legislature, we'll have more professional testimony in that arena.
Well, if there's no further discussion, once again, thank you all for being here. Thank you for your testimony. We look forward to hearing from you before we move further. With that, we can adjourn the meeting.